With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Like I said, I'm a big, I think the Mayfair Curzon was one of the first theaters I went to when I visited England.
I'll tell the guys at the office.
Excellent.
Thank you so much. Lovely to meet you.
Lovely to meet you too. Thanks for talking.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. In this episode, we've got more history revision than the Spark Notes bibliography as we talk to Quentin Tarantino about his new filmland fairy tale. Plus, Christian Petzold's back and he's got a new film in transit. Jake Cunningham, and today I'm delighted to be sharing scenes from the QT with some QTs. Kelly Powell.
Hello.
And from Little White Lies, Hannah Woodhead.
Hi.
And looks like a background artist has stumbled onto set as Sam Howlett's here as well.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't think so, actually.
Hey, I use the right language at least. You're not an extra. You're not extra to me. You are extra.
How would they call them now? Background artists?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Times have changed.
Update your lexicon, Hannah. all right, so we've got a couple of films to get into this week. We're going to start with Transit, which is going to be in cinemas and on demand. And Sam, you're going to tell us a little bit about that one before we get into it.
Sure. So Transit is Christian Petzold's latest, he of Barbara and Phoenix. So this film is about a man named Georg who is in France during a German invasion. And while there, he takes the papers of a dead writer and assumes his identity in order to escape France for a better life away from the invasion. While there, he falls in love with the dead writer's wife and the film gets very twisty-turny. But the big thing about the premise of this film is that it's based on a novel set during World War II, whereas this film takes pretty much the exact same story and applies it to a modern-day setting.
What?
I know.
That's mad.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I don't think I understood that the first time I watched it. And that's probably why.
This documentary is very intense.
I remember when I first saw this, I remember being extremely confused.
It is a really confounding and confusing and sort of labyrinthine film. If you like don't have any kind of precursor to what it is. I remember we watched it together and we were very like, I'm not sure. For the first half hour, it took a while to really understand what the film is doing.
Okay.
That premise.
Because it doesn't really give you a guidebook.
No, there's no title card at the beginning. It's just suddenly German troops are invading Paris in the modern day.
Right.
And there's no kind of...
But there are like anachronistic elements. So like, you know, when he finds the writer's stuff, it's all on typewriter. And then you're like, wait, are we
Where
back
are
in
we?
Time? Like, we don't. It's confusing. It is confusing. But I also think it's clever.
Yeah.
But it's not confusing in a plot sense.
No,
it's confusing as in terms of a sense of space and the
it
world.
It throws you straight
temporally.
In.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, yeah, a little bit like something like It Follows, where you feel like you've got a sense of this. Is this like a Stranger Things 80s thing? But then also there's a mobile phone, but also it looks like a seashell.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
But in a way, that's quite fun. And I suppose like it's just putting you in that discombobulating space that anyone caught in the transit of war would also be swept up in as well, this constantly changing location and time.
Exactly.
And identity. At the centre of it, you've got a really interesting performance from Rakowski, Franz Rakowski, who's kind of got these kind of sunken eyes and just kind of...
He's very Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah.
Very Joaquin Phoenix.
He's very interesting to look to watch.
Yeah.
To look at and
to look
watch.
At and to watch, exactly.
He just has such a kind of unassuming, like, gentle way about him. He's also in Terrence Malick's new film in a supporting role, Hidden Life, and he's very good in that. But it's similar kind of, like, very, like, softly spoken, kind of, you know, just living his little life. And this is the first film I'd seen him in. He's been kind of around for a while, I think. But I think this is, like, really quite... For such a role that kind of... It's not a big, showy role. A lot of the time he's just waiting in corridors or listening to other people talk.
Or queuing. And, a lot of queuing
A lot of queuing. Good queuing
I
movie.
I feel his pain. Just applied for a visa, I get it.
Oh, God. I think the endless bureaucracy is just... It gives you a real sense of kind of the how boring it is to be stuck in this endless, like,
and you literally are like you are in this weird liminal space that you can't go anywhere. It is basically they all are stuck in this sort of purgatory.
He tells that great anecdote slash like story about the man who is waiting to go to hell, and that's what it feels like. The whole film is just kind of waiting to decide if you're going to hell or not. Especially because he's playing opposite Paula Beer, who's playing this kind of like wispy, like very glamorous looking woman looking for her dead husband, and he's kind of just even the way like he dresses, he's like kind of, you know, shabby and you know, hunched over, like really beaten down by life.
We're not exactly making it sound like a romp.
No, but it is definitely a thriller.
It's really good.
Yeah,
exactly. Holocaust refugee.
Yeah, that's it. Like, because
it's really tense.
Yeah, this. Yeah, like, there's some that lives of others quality.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good comparison. Yeah.
And you're constantly waiting for something bad to happen.
Yeah.
Because you know that's what happens during the.
I think the film builds up tension really well, and even small things towards the end, you're like. Everything hangs on the decision that he makes, you know? You're like, no, don't do that! You're very invested. I thought it was an excellently paced movie.
Okay.
And yeah, you do kind of get very invested in his journey. Mm.
Okay, well, talking of things building up to terrible events, should we move on to our second film of the week?
Sure.
From one historical rewrite to another. And this is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is a film I have to say I was not excited about in the slightest. but I'll tell you a little about it first. So this is Quentin Tarantino's ninth feature set on the kaleidoscopic, expansive Hollywood backlots. And they're featuring their sun-dappled stars and how they rub against the countercultural forces of 1969. We've got movie moguls, hippie burnouts, Steve McQueen, Bruce Lee, and our main guides through this are Rick fucking Dalton and an action hero on the wane, and his lovely stunt double friend Cliff Booth, and then alongside them we've also got Margot Robbie playing Sharon Tate as behind the camera something far more dangerous than your star waning steps into the spotlight. Can I just ask around the table, I've kind of played my hand already there, your thoughts on Quentin Tarantino going into this, Hannah?
I'm a big Tarantino fan for my sins. He's like one of the filmmakers that got me into film to start with. I remember going to see Inglourious Basterds when I was 16. I got my brother to buy me the tickets because he was older than me, and my mind was blown. I was just like, wow, this is what you can do with cinema. And I was excited for this, even though I think hearing the words Quentin Tarantino is going to make a film about the Manson murders is like, ooh, no. Yeah. Like, you know, it doesn't sound like the most kind. I thought that, I think I said this in my review for Little White Lies, that the potential for this to go so badly wrong was extremely high, and it was I mean I should have trusted him, but I was like, this could be in incredibly poor taste.
I'm about 50-50 on his films. The last one that I liked was Inglourious Bastards. Sam,
Ellie? massive fan. I remember getting the Tarantino box set on DVD when I was younger, and I got through those pretty quickly. And yeah, I've been a massive fan ever since. And I think every time he releases a film, it's a big event. Like, sort of everything stops when he releases a film, and everyone's like, okay, how is this one going to be compared to the rest? And I do get why people have kind of lost their excitement around him sometimes, like yourself. I do agree that things like Django and The Hateful Eight weren't quite his best because they are very long. They're quite bloated. It feels like he's crammed a lot of just his brain into them. But, you know, like I said, I'm always excited to see what he's doing. And I think this is definitely one of his best.
Kelly, you both love him and were well up for this idea as well of him doing Man's.
Yeah. I was totally on board. I was like, yeah, okay, show me what you got. No, I love him.
And you were lucky enough to speak to him as well.
A very scary moment for me because he is one of my idols. He also was one of the filmmakers that got me very interested in film when I was younger. And I was also trepidatious given his track record sometimes if you offend him slightly in an interview. So I kept it very much above board. And he had some very interesting things to say about the film. And he was lovely to talk to, actually. And it was a very, very enjoyable conversation.
Quentin Tarantino, thank you so much for coming onto the Curzon Film Podcast.
Cool.
I loved the film a lot. I wanted it to be longer.
No.
I didn't want it to end.
Thank you.
So the film takes place in 1969, which is the turn of the decade. Mm-hmm. And it's taking place during a period of a lot of changes, politically, culturally, ideologically. And I wanted to ask you about your choice to contextualize the film against the backdrop of the Manson family during what is ostensibly the end of the golden age of Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the thing about it was very interesting to set a movie in Los Angeles County in 1969. It's interesting to kind of come up with some characters. There are a variation of composites of some real people, and then also throw some real people in there.
Yes.
But one of the things that's also very disturbing about that time is there is this Manson family there. And, I mean, it's crazy the weird little connections that they had just in the framework of the Los Angeles Hollywood community. I mean, just even like, I mean, whether it's minor, like a couple little things is, you know, the house that Sharon Tate lives in Cielo Drive, the reason the Mansons knew about it is because Terry Melcher, who is like the producer boy wonder of Columbia Records, he created Paul Revere and the Raiders, he lived there. So they knew the place from visiting him. Not only that, the piano that you see Abigail Folger playing Straight Shooter on, that's the piano. Because at one point, Mark Lindsay, the lead singer of Paul Revere and the Raiders, lived with Terry Melcher at that house. He wrote the song Good Thing on that piano. All right, or even just the fact that Terry Melcher is Doris Day's son. And so he comes from Hollywood lineage. Mm. See, there's all these three, 6 degrees of separation between the Manson family and all these weird people, weird celebrity luminaries from Hollywood. So I look at it as like I'm painting a really pretty picture. Now, it's a memory piece, so there's going to be a little bit of rose-colored glasses here. But I'm painting a really beautiful oil painting of Hollywood at that time. But the family is like painting has got mildew on it, like on this little corner here and this little side here. And that mildew is little by little through the course of the movie spreading into the painting and into the picture.
Okay. So your film explores the illusion and myth-making behind, the American dream.
Yeah.
And which is sort of constructed and reinforced by Hollywood and the Dream Factory itself. And this comes in many forms, but most notably, you know, the dwindling careers of Rick and Cliff. Yet, cast as these characters are two of the biggest Hollywood stars today.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about your choice when it came to that, casting these two amazing actors?
Well, they're these huge movie stars, and I definitely take advantage of their charisma that they have. But like you just said, they're two terrific actors. And they just invested in the characters in just wonderful ways. So it was, and also they, the two characters between Rick and Cliff, it's weird. There's a, I think in all my movies, there's a duality that goes on in between subjects and characters inside of the same film. And now this one is almost, that's the point of it. But on one hand, they have to go together. Because one is literally the double of the other one. So he's got to actually look a little bit like the guy. He's got to really look like the guy when he puts on the guy's clothes.
Yeah.
And he's got to literally function in a movie on screen as the guy's double. But their personalities could not be more different. Rick is just as a bundle of neurotic nerves. And he faces all these trials and tribulations. Unfortunately, they're all of his own making. You know, he's inventing all of them for himself. Cliff, who by comparison seemingly has nothing by comparison to his boss, seems to just exist in this Zen state where everything is good. Now, there's a reason for that when you find out that, like, he could be in jail for the rest of his life. So any day he's not in jail for the rest of his life is pretty good as far as he's concerned. So there's a reason why for his strange serenity. But I think that was... But those are two great characters to bounce off of each other in that regard.
Yes, definitely. You know, your characters in your movies are usually larger than life in the very, very best way. But there's something about these two characters, this buddy couple, that feel very vulnerable.
Yeah.
And they feel to me like real people playing characters rather than being characters existing in a movie.
Thank you.
And they also are populated in this world that they have actors playing real people.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to ask you, did that affect, you know, the way that the form of the film in any way, you know, the way that you saw dialogue or the way that you shot the film?
You know, the answer to that question is not really, but one, not really. I didn't quite realize how different they were until, frankly, to tell you the truth, I started reading reviews. All right. Because, to me, they were just like my characters, and I always invest a tremendous amount in my characters, and I always think of them as three-dimensional characters. Having said that, though, I've heard some different reviews, and they've made a couple interesting points that I've never, because I'm in my stuff, so I try not to look outwards until right now.
Yeah, afterwards.
Yeah, people started making the case that, look, my characters can be good, they can be three-dimensional, whatever, they can be all that. But for the last at least decade or so, they have been genre archetypes.
Yeah.
Now, I don't quite think about them that way, all right? I think about them as real people, as well I should. But I guess at the end of the day, they are genre archetypes. And these characters aren't. They're, Rick is the character who plays genre archetypes. And just even the fact that he's probably my first lead character that is just plagued with self-doubt. Jackie Brown had her own self-doubt and had her own problems and was working to fight them out. At the same time, she's still kind of a realistic blaxploitation archetype, and it's also based on a novel. So as much as I changed the character, the basic character was still Elmer Leonard's character. In this case, this bundle of neuroses that is Rick was mine from the very beginning. And I guess that is quite different from what I normally write.
Yes, exactly. Well, I think it feels like a very personal film to you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your love of Hollywood, as people have said, it's a love letter to Hollywood, mm-hmm. You know. Was it always going to be at this time that you made this film? Have you had the idea in mind all the time, or...?
No, I've had this idea, I think sometime after, I've been working on it, like, solidly for sections for the last 5 years, but I think I first came up with it sometime around after Death Proof is when I first kind of came up with the idea, but I wasn't in any hurry. So, you know, like the guy pushes the rock up the hill for so long for
Sisyphus.
The rest of his life.
Yeah.
I can never say that now, obviously. So when I say it, it sounds like syphilis. All right, you know. In between whatever I was doing, I would just kind of push that rock up the hill further until I abandoned it. And this time I was doing that again, and all of a sudden, hey, shit, I'm going to get to the top. This is going to happen. I guess that's what I'm doing. So that was actually kind of cool, pushing it up there. I think it all worked out in the best way, because if I did it 5 years earlier, I don't think I would have got these guys. I really don't think Margot would be in it, and I can't even imagine the movie without Margot. But then there's other things. Okay, like for instance, if I had done the movie say 8 years ago, but okay, we'll say 10, for sure 10 years ago. So say 2009 or something. Mm-hmm. It would be looked at a little differently. I mean, for instance, like in 2009, most of the big critics out would have been alive from 1969. Most of the big critics were like much older than I was, mm-hmm. you know, 9 years ago or 10 years ago. Now most of the critics are younger than I am, you know, so there would have been a frame of reference mm. that a Todd McCarthy or somebody from Variety would have that somebody writing for bloodydisgusting.com doesn't have.
Yes. Yes. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Like I said, I'm a big, I think the Mayfair Curzon was one of the first theaters I went to when I visited England.
I'll tell the guys at the office.
Excellent.
Thank you so much. Lovely to meet you.
Lovely to meet you too. Thanks for talking.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Thank you, Quentin. Right, so I said I'm not really up for Quentin Tarantino. I was really not up for this film. Definitely not him doing the Manson murders, that's for sure. Absolute shocker, lads. loved it. It's really good, isn't it?
It is really good, yeah. It's so good.
Yeah. Weirdly, I know, Hannah, you're not a fan, but this is, like, to me, the closest we'll get to a Quentin Tarantino, Richard Linklater film.
Oh. It's a stretch.
Yeah.
Well,
but it's just a hangout, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, that's what I really loved about the
Quentin
film.
Quentin Tarantino's Dazed and Confused.
Yeah.
It's very much like that. It's very much just this kind of like day in the life of these almost slacker characters just hanging out on the sun-drenched streets of California, just doing their thing. And that's not what you expect from a Tarantino film in the slightest. Like, think of how much happens in the first hour of Django. So much happens, and then you've still got like almost 2 hours left of still so many things happening, so many shootouts, so many twists, so many this and that.
So many Australian accents.
So many Australian accents that shouldn't have been done. This is so like 2 hours in, really barely anything has happened in terms of plot. It's great.
It's really good. And I kind of think that this is the best time that his dialogue and characters have been deployed because the setting actually makes sense.
Mm.
Like, even though everything is super heightened and it is a fairy tale, this is also the most realistic that they felt because these characters that, or these people that like just chew on dialogue and come up with mad things to say in a 60s Hollywood setting on back lots and trailers and things, it kind of works.
Totally. Mm. Yeah. I spoke to him about that. And I was very interested in the fact that it's so multi-layered, this film, in subtle and not so subtle ways. But they do feel like the most vulnerable of his characters. And they're not the larger-than-life, as I mentioned in the interview, they're not the larger-than-life characters or caricatures sometimes that we find in a Tarantino movie. But, these guys, these protagonists, feel very real in a world that's very, it doesn't feel nostalgic. It feels romanticized in a way, but also based in reality. And you feel like he is kind of just recreating the Hollywood that he, you know, loved.
Well, and filling it with nice people. Like that's a shocker as well.
Deplorable human beings.
Is this like since Jackie Brown, has he actually had nice people in his films that you kind of root for or like can empathize with?
Yeah, in Inglourious Bastards. Shoshana. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Shoshana.
As much as I've enjoyed his previous films, there's not a lot of characters that I've really connected with or haven't had any like emotional payoff from them. And this is the only time that I've Like, I welled up.
Well, I think usually his characters
which I've not come close
underground,
to.
Hitmen, yeah. criminals, assassins,
mm. yeah.
this and that. Even Jackie Brown is a fully, you know, sort of like drugs trafficking, money laundering, you know. These are the first Tarantino characters I can think of that have actually pretty much just been someone you could, I know they're Hollywood, but that, you know, definitely Brad Pitt's character is someone you could easily live next door to and see every day and not really bat an eyelid. Mm.
And they were rare for him. I would definitely.
I mean,
oh yeah.
But I mean, the friendship, that the whole film is really just about this friendship between Rick and Cliff, and it is the sweetest relationship I think in any Tarantino film.
Yeah,
they really do like love each other so much. It is very touching to watch.
Such a
I think Leo cries like 3 times in this film.
Yeah, he
like,
does.
Little Rick's a very emotional guy, and I was not expecting to go into a Tarantino film and come out thinking like, that was really sweet.
Yeah, really, like, yeah, heartfelt.
You
kind
know,
of.
It really does feel like one straight from the heart from Quentin.
Yeah,
and I don't think any of his films have really dealt with like friendship in that way.
Mm.
Yeah, he's made a film about friendship, but you know, like, all the kind of relationship between men in his other films are like kind of built on either like Jules and Vincent being like colleagues, or you know, in Reservoir Dogs, it's like there's something horrible.
There's macho-ness to them as well.
Yeah. There's always something kind of horrible that ties people together. And in this film, it's not really that at all. It's kind of the opposite. It's just like...
The buddy movie.
Yeah, it really
sweet
is.
Sweet buddy movie.
Yeah, true. And I think, for me, Leo is better here than he was in The Revenant.
Which don't get on The Revenant.
Gotten the Oscar for. But like, he has such a variety of performances within Rick Dalton.
Mm.
It reminded me of Catch Me If You Can, his work in that, where he, like, you can get a sense of him, you can get a sense of the characters that he's playing and where they intertwine, and he's not just like slogging through the pain and showing you how much he can feel all the time.
I mean, he's an actor playing an actor, playing roles in like films and TV, which I think is kind of incredible to watch, you know, the way he turns it on, off and on in the film. So when you see Rick like kind of off screen, he's a bit of a mess, he has a stutter, and he's kind of, as I already said, he's always crying. But as soon as he kind of goes on set, he's, you know, total professional. Like, you know, there's a beautiful moment where he's waiting to go on set with the child actress who plays kind of opposite him in one of the TV shows that Rick Dalton is doing, and they have this wonderful exchange where she's basically like giving him a pep talk about how to be an actor, and then they go and do their scene together, and it's the bit from the trailer where she like whispers in his ear, "That was the best acting I've ever seen," and he kind of loses it. And you know, I do kind of wonder how much of Leo is in this character, because you know, he's been around a very long time, and I think for a while there was kind of like, oh, where did Leonardo DiCaprio go? Like, you know, he, especially before The Revenant, it's like, oh, he really wants that Oscar. He's not got it. And now, you know, he took a few years off after that, right? I think rightly so. But yeah, for me, I think this is definitely like his best work in years, and in a just world, he would have got his Oscar for this.
But, yeah, you know. Absolutely. Well, he may still get it.
Yeah, I don't know.
For me, the stand-up performance is Brad Pitt.
Yeah?
He's
so
good. I love how he's this sort of, he's this old stuntman, this old sort of relic of the golden age of Hollywood, and he can't get the same work he used to because of a reason with Bruce Lee. And he's this sort of old, beaten up, past his sellboy day, old cowboy. And that could be a really sad character, but this character doesn't really care. He's quite happy just living in his trailer, feeding his dog, just being Rick Dalton's right-hand man.
He's also still very cool.
Exactly. He's so like cool. He's so cool he doesn't care that he's past his sellboy date. Whereas Rick Dalton's losing his mind.
He doesn't know that he's cool.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
Rick, exactly. Rick thinks he's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
And his scene with Bruce Lee is incredible. And the scene where he visits the Manson Ranch is fantastic.
Scene on the Spahn Ranch. Like, it's like the standout.
Yeah,
but that's like a proper horror scene.
Yeah, it's everything.
Reminds me a lot of in Inglourious Basterds, the scene where they're in the bar. I think that scene is too long. I think this one is kind of pitched too right.
We said before we started that Inglourious Basterds couldn't be cut down.
That one scene, I think, could be cut down in Inglourious Basterds because it does go on for a very long time. But in Hollywood, this scene on the Spahn Ranch where Cliff is kind of goes out there and is trying to work out kind of what's going on. It is like, it's like a straight horror film. You're, again, as in transit, you're waiting for something horrible to happen. And you're kind of like, oh God, this is not going to end well. Especially having the knowledge of where he is as well. You're like, okay.
And we're in a Tarantino movie and we haven't seen any blood yet.
Yeah, you know? You're waiting. You're like, when's it going to start? It's going to start soon. When's it
going
to start?
Right. So again, going back to waiting for bad things to happen, there's a bit of a Margot Robbie shaped elephant in the room that we haven't spoken about.
Right. Yeah.
So that was my big grievance going into this film, hearing Quentin Tarantino plus Manson murders. And I really didn't like the idea of that as well. And I've been listening to, you must remember this, the Manson series that's all kind of giving you the Manson.
To it. It's very good.
It's really good. Would recommend for anyone listening to this who wants to kind of build their knowledge of that. I kind of had a rough idea of Manson and Sharon Tate and that, but not a lot more. And that's really helped fill in the blanks. But I think this film actually does an amazing job of humanizing Sharon Tate, of giving her a life beyond just being
podcast that we're listening to very much talks about, how Sharon Tate is now just famous for being a victim of the Manson murders, whereas this film actually doesn't really treat her like that, and it gives her some really nice moments that may or may not have happened, but she feels like a really fully rounded character.
Yeah, we've mentioned the film being so sweet, so warm-hearted. Mm. Like, there's a bit where she goes to watch a film that she is in, and that is so sweet, and you really feel for her. And she kind of, she views the world in such an interesting way. Like, you watch Margot Robbie's performance, it doesn't feel like you're just watching her be her. Like, she's got these wide eyes that, even when she's driving a car, it's like she's looking around, like she's captured this dream that she had of Hollywood, and she's really viewing it and taking it all in and properly living it. And it becomes this celebration of her, as well as being this celebration of Hollywood and those movies at the time that Tarantino maybe wanted to make, and then found this way of wrapping in this expectation of violence that people might expect from the Tarantino film as well. It's really interesting. And you have these three roles of Rick and Cliff and Sharon, and then there's their convergence kind of within the final 25 minutes or so, which will divide people. I mean, there are flashes of your Tarantinoisms that I didn't go for in that final act, but I feel like the kind of maybe even final five, I suddenly was... crying and was like, oh, what? I was not expecting this from QT.
Yeah.
It's a good film.
It's a really good film.
Really good.
Yeah. And it's the only time that I've come out of his films and thought, I would quite happily go back and watch that again.
Can't wait to see it again.
Yeah. Immediately. I wanted to watch it again immediately.
Yeah. And it's super long. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And
doesn't feel like it.
Yeah, the take I'll leave you with is that it's the only one of his long films that is worth being as long as it is.
That's not true at all.
We don't agree with that.
That's not the opinion of the podcast.
So on that sign of unity with my opinion... I think just literally for, we do these recommendations, like, this is for fans of
Tarantino and
but I think this could bring in other people.
Yeah, I agree.
Even your La La Landers could get something out of it.
Sure.
I mean, I think for anyone that's kind of turned off by Tarantino's violence, this is his most accessible film up until the last 10 minutes. if you don't like violence, maybe turn it off 15 minutes before the end.
Yeah, but then Come back to it.
Yeah, like, there's like one scene and then, you know, it goes back to being lovely.
Yeah.
Well, it's great when a filmmaker can do something that they're like, okay, my fans would definitely like this, but also new people as well.
But at the same time,
he's
I think he's just reaching out, isn't he?
He's just opening his arms.
I think, you know, I saw a Xavier Dolan film last year in Toronto called The Death and Life of John F. Donovan.
So you're the one that saw that.
Me and a single cinema, the only people to have seen this movie. But that, to me, this is tangential, but I think it is related. That, to me, felt like Xavier Dolan being like, this is me and I don't care what anyone thinks. And, you know, it was a very...
People didn't like it.
And the people said no.
People did not like it. And then his latest film was at Cannes at the same time as Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which felt much more kind of like he was like, okay, I'm going to dial it back and make something that's really personal and just like... doesn't feel like I've got anything to prove. And I think Hollywood feels like that. It feels like a kind of a filmmaker who's been around for a long time now and has faced a lot of kind of criticism, but he's made his peace with that. He's made his peace with the fact that people aren't always going to like his movies. He, for me, seems to have kind of grown up a bit. I think that you know, there's far less kind of like masculine showboating in this film. And
it's his least showy film.
Yeah, like, definitely. Yeah. And again, like if you're kind of going into it hoping for like, you know, ultra violence and swearing and everything, you're going to probably be disappointed. But yeah, I it really worked for me on so many levels.
Great. All right. So that'll be on, that'll be in cinemas this Wednesday, the 14th of August. And it's also on 35mm screenings at Curzon's. So check their website, see which screenings, which locations you can get to on that. But I would recommend seeing it like that if you can. Sam, is there anything happening on home cinema beyond Transit?
So we've got Transit, we've got Christian Petzold's previous films, Barbara and Phoenix, and our Curzon 12 selection this month. So that's films you can watch for free if you have a Curzon membership. Once Upon a Time in dot, dot, dot. So we've picked 12 different countries to match with that theme. So, for example, Once Upon a Time in Turkey, we've got Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. Once Upon a Time in France, we've got Weekend, etc., etc. We've got Fish Tank, Once Upon a Time in England.
Oh, lovely. All right. So that is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Transit. If you've got any thoughts on them, you can always let us know on Twitter by tweeting at Curzon Cinemas, or you can tweet us all directly as well. I'm over there at Jake H. Cunningham. Kelly, you're on Twitter as?
KS underscore Powell.
Sam?
At Sam Howlett underscore one.
Anna. Good job, Liz.
That good job, Liz. And thank you so much for listening. If it's your first time listening to the show, then do subscribe. You can do it on iTunes, Spotify, Acast, wherever you get your podcasts. And whilst you're there, if you could leave us a review or a comment, that would be absolutely wonderful. But until then, from the Sunset Strip, farewell.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.